Hello, everybody, and welcome to this month's free preview for the What a Cartoon Movie episode all about the movie Dexter's Lab Ego Trip. I am one of your hosts, the frequent typer, Bob Mackey, who is here with me today.
Hey, it's Henry Gilbert.
Hey, that was very good. But again, welcome to this extended preview of a very long episode. In case you don't know what's going on, every month we talk about a movie in length, and these podcasts are normally 2 to 3 times longer than our normal podcast. Our most recent one we did before this was 5 hours long.
Yeah. Yes,
our longest one to date. I don't think we're going to beat the end of Evangelion.
It's too perfect that end of Evangelion was exactly 5 hours. I wouldn't want, if we posted like a 5-hour and 7-minute podcast, I'd be like, it doesn't feel the same.
Let's delete 7 minutes. But yeah. For this one, not nearly that long, but still super, super long. We talk all about a movie that is not really lost the time, but not talked about enough. And that was the first Cartoon Network original movie based on the amazing series Dexter's Laboratory. We talk not only about the series as a whole, we also talk about the What a Cartoon TV show, not the podcast, that spawned Dexter's Lab, and then we talk about the movie in full for our normal in-depth discussion with clips and lots of trivia and fun things about the show and the movie that spawned from the show. So
yeah, we got so much new and renewed appreciation for Genndy Tartakovsky and his team's creation on Dexter's Lab that we think really gets overlooked. And so we put a real spotlight on it, especially this special that you can find on YouTube, mm-hmm. but not in any official place for whatever reason. I'm not sure why. But yeah, this was a ton of fun to talk about. Bob did a great, great job on the history. And it's just our most recent of over 2 years of What a Cartoon Movie content that we've been doing.
That's right. If you want to hear the whole thing, please go to patreon.com/talkingsimpsons. Sign up there at the $10 level. You get to hear the rest of this podcast in full. It's probably going to be about 4 hours long. We have not edited it yet as of this recording, but it's edited now for you, for your convenience. And then also, once you're at that level, you will get access to the previous 24 episodes of What a Cartoon Movie. And that, I dare say, is probably like, what, like 80 hours of content?
Oh, I bet it's close to 100 now. Yeah. And that would be in addition to all of the other great $10 benefits we have, and the $5 stuff. If you're not yet a $5 subscriber, you're missing out on dozens and dozens of exclusive to Patreon podcasts of us covering shows like Futurama, King of the Hill, The Critic, and Mission Hill in the same in-depth style. You will have a cornucopia of content ahead of you, and you'll also, if you sign up at $10, you'll already get the February one we're going to be doing for What a Cartoon Movie, the Ghibli film Whisper of the Heart, and you know that's going to be a big one too. So you have so much to look forward to. If you enjoy the big clip we're going to share with you on this, you definitely want to sign up for the full deal at patreon.com/talkingsimpsons.
So that is it for this little intro from us, and please enjoy this portion of our very long history about Dexter's Lab and the movie Ego Trip.
In Dexter's Laboratory lives the smartest boy you've ever seen, but Didi blows his experiments to smithereens. There is gloom and doom while things go boom in Dexter's Lab.
Let's talk about the history of the first version of Dexter's Lab. So a brief overview of it. Dexter's Lab ran for 52 episodes, and that comprised 147 segments from April 29th, 1996 to June 8th, 1998. So that was 2 seasons of this show over the course of like 2 years and, I don't know, 2 months. So it all came out in that tiny period of time.
Yeah, I remember every new episode of Dexter felt like an event, I think, because they didn't just dump it. 52 is, you know, like a standard order that's one for every like week of the year, but they didn't, it was different than a syndication dump. Like they're like, oh, a new Dexter. I think Cartoon Network was obviously still learning about like, how do we promote a new episode of something? We've only been Hanna-Barbera reruns for so long.
Well, now they're like, we're going to release 8 at once on an app you won't use. So
yes,
that's their strategy now. But back then I was looking at the wiki of like air dates, and man, they, when they had new batches of episodes, they never missed a week. Like there were no delays or, you know, episodes stuck in production, they were pumping these out so quickly because they had a team of super, super young guys making this show.
Yes, yeah, who seemed to dedicate, like, everything to making that series. And yeah, they pumped it out fast. And to see it now, like, it's great to watch it on HBO Max. I was dipping into about a dozen or so episodes in the lead up to this, and you can see that it's like this playground or testing ground for all of these other creators. Like, when I see the opening credits, I see so many names like, oh, that guy went on to that, and that guy went on to that. Like, and it's all guys. It's a very male show, I will say.
It's all men. Yeah, and going back to the show, it made me realize that secretly, it's kind of been, I don't think this has been forgotten, but I think this concept has been forgotten, that Dexter's Lab is one of the most important shows of the 90s. Like, this started the original cartoons on Cartoon Network. Everyone from this show went on to become huge. And my little analogy I have that I think is imperfect is that for Cartoon Network, Dexter's Lab was their Ren and Stimpy, and then Powerpuff Girls was their SpongeBob.
Yeah,
that is my imperfect analogy, but I think it kind of holds water.
Yeah, definitely Dexter made the pipeline for Cartoon Network Studios. Like, it, and it created a house style that would be replicated from then on. And only it took, like, you know, more than a decade before a new house style starts to develop for what Cartoon Network is. I think that kind of starts with the Flapjack, I guess. But even Flapjack is, like, so indebted to Dexter's Lab. Same with like Steven Universe, Adventure Time, all regular show. Those shows owe so much to it. Like, and it, I always call back to it, but our friend Ian Jones Quarty, the way he coined the phrase, it just sticks with me so much.
Yes.
Like, Hanna-Barbaname.
That's in my notes. Yeah. I wrote that in my notes. So thank you, Ian, who might be listening to this. I want to talk about the origins of Dexter's Lab. So they go all the way back to the very namesake of this podcast, the What a Cartoon program on Cartoon Network. People ask me all the time. They ask me a few times, actually, like, how are you guys allowed to use the same name? The answer is, I don't know. No one has ever contacted us about it. So there's your answer.
Yes. Yeah. I guess AT&T could get in our face about this, but fortunately they don't.
No, like, they don't really care. But in case you don't know, What a Cartoon on Cartoon Network was a pilot program of sorts. And it borrowed that Nicktoons energy by focusing on creator-driven cartoons that were written via storyboard, the classic way of making cartoons. So they were, much like Nicktoons, trying to rejuvenate the world of children's entertainment.
Yeah, because the 80s were a rough time for American animation. It was this huge, from my personal standpoint, the most interesting stuff about 80s animation to me is when they hire anime production studios
basically
to make their stuff, or if some of my favorite comic book writers, you know, would write an episode of G.I. Joe or Transformers or the like. Like, those were some of my favorite things. But most American productions, like, were good in spite of themselves, like, of a cheap, like, the, especially with Filmation, even worse than what Hanna-Barbera did. Not that, I mean, Hanna-Barbera with Smurfs, that's a bad decade, you know?
Yeah, and actually, before Dexter's Lab, Smurfs was their last big hit.
And it was so huge, but it was, like, the last, it was the dying of the light of Hanna-Barbera. It's, but yeah, so you just had this, like, rough decade of stuff. And so then you have these, you know, guys who grew up idolizing the generation before that and even before that, and who are finally, like, in a kind of a rebellious young male energy. They're like, fuck that, man. We're not doing it that way. Like, and that is typified by guys like John Kay.
Yeah, who I believe
sucks.
Was a kind of a consultant on this project. I'm surprised they didn't have him do something, but at the same time, I'm not.
No, I mean, they did try to get it. I think it's an interesting thing. Like, you see that, like, Yogi Bear thing he made and the...
Oh, yeah. Those are kind of like pilots for potential Spumco versions of those characters.
I think that's the thing. He got, like, to this prestige level where he's like, I'm not making an original thing for you. I want to play with the characters I loved. But that also meant that he worked forever on shit that barely was finished, and it kept him away from infecting things more. But these, I'm sure the guys who worked on Dexter's Lab would not say they appreciate John K. now,
yes.
But in the simpler, happier times, he and others were such an influential figures in creating this new generation of animation in the 90s.
And so What a Cartoon was spearheaded by a guy we'll be talking a lot about during this podcast. So it's Fred Seibert. So Fred Seibert was the final president of Hanna-Barbera's cartoon studio before it was purchased and dissolved into Time Warner in like 1997-ish. So Fred Seibert is a legendary figure in the world of cable television. Some brief facts about him. He's got an incredible like backstory, an incredible history, but he was basically MTV's creative director and essentially established the brand of MTV, like the cool logo, the I Want My MTV campaign. Like, he was the guy who gave MTV the cool counterculture flavor that made it so huge in the throughout the 80s.
Man, yeah, that's part of getting older is noticing, like, oh, the promotional programs around the things I loved were part of what pulled me in, and like that, Seibert has such influence being in charge of that stuff.
Yeah, and interest in animation, especially with all of those cool MTV bumpers. Like, let's hire people to make weird things for us and put them on TV.
Yeah, yeah. We owe it to like a handful of executives like him who found these like, you know, angry stoner dudes and just say like, here, I'll give you, here's a bunch of corporate money. Draw something fucked up, please, as long as an MTV logo's in the middle of it.
It's like 3 years of beer money. So yeah, Seibert, mega huge in the world of cable. Another important thing he did was with his ad team, he basically transformed Nickelodeon in the mid-80s. So our friend Pop Arena, check out their channel on YouTube. It's a history of Nickelodeon, the series called Knickknacks, and you can see where it turns from a kind of like fuzzy, educational, boring network, frankly, to the slime-covered game show, wacky cartoon thing that we know and love. Like,
yeah.
And he is the guy responsible for Nickelodeon being successful. So Fred Seibert, an amazing career.
Yeah, yeah. That I love Pop Arena's content. I've learned a ton from it, too. And that, yeah, you really see how Seibert and others, their development process is what changed these channels into what we are, the homes of what we loved, and gave, they are the people who give the opportunities to the people who the creators we enjoy.
So when Seibert ended up at Hanna-Barbera, he was like, why don't we make something good? Because within the industry and probably outside of the industry, Hanna-Barbera was like, that's where your career goes to die, making cartoons there. Like, Hanna-Barbera was just like the factory that just spewed out boring garbage for children, very unimaginative things, following trends, just really, really cheap and awful cartoons. But he was like, why don't we make good cartoons at Hanna-Barbera? And the two made under his watch were Two Stupid Dogs and SWAT Cats.
Hell yeah.
So outside of A Pup Named Scooby-Doo, I'm going to say between the Flintstones and those three, the best things they ever made, probably. I mean, I can't think of, like, were there any good, like, 70s Hanna-Barbera cartoons? Any good 80s Hanna-Barbera cartoons?
I mean, they were all Scooby.
Yeah.
Like, if after Scooby, everything else was Scooby. And the 80s, doing the Scooby research for Zombie Island, I was like, God, so much junk. And like how that one of the last things Bill and Joe oversaw was that Scooby-Doo Arabian Nights thing, which was utter trash, like ugly, ugly looking thing.
Yeah, it was not a good time for Hanna-Barbera, but yeah, he did make quality shows through them. Those are some of his earlier productions they made under his watch. Mm. And, you know, I don't want to be unfair, but I honestly can't think of anything outside of those three shows that I would consider good cartoons for kids. I mean, Scooby-Doo is fun, a lot of nostalgia. I don't think it's good.
Well,
I don't think it's a quality show.
I'd say also after the first one, they all get considerably
That's
worse.
True.
Same with, like, you know, the Flintstone kids, like that was junk, or the Tom and Jerry kids, like, ugh, that early 90s thing, like
disgusting. I forgot that was them too.
Yeah, Hannah, that was like when Hanna-Barbera could make Tom and Jerry again. It's like, wow, they can finally make Tom and Jerry again. What are they gonna do? And it's a fucking Muppet Babies.
They're like, not violent, and Tom has a dumb red hat for some reason.
And Droopy needs a kid. Like, that's the character Droopy. Like,
I think his name is Triple.
Oh god.
Or Dribble?
Yeah, yeah.
It's disgusting either way.
Yeah, that was the junk they were making. And then it felt so exciting as a kid who I was just used to the Hanna-Barbera junk and accepted it. Like, oh yeah, Smurfs and all this other stuff. I was never a Smurf kid. Listen to the cartoon All-Stars to the Rescue. Hated when those Smurfs showed up. But yeah, the Two Stupid Dogs is like Ren and Stimpy through the Barbera machine. And SWAT Cats is like, let's just work with an anime company and make cool action for toys that never get made.
Unfortunately, though, those two cartoons, Two Stupid Dogs and SWAT Cats, according to Cybert, they were not financially successful. But they did show the world that Hanna-Barbera can make quality things. And this would continue with this idea for this What a Cartoon program. So at first, it was known as World Premiere Toons. I couldn't pin down a date as to when that changed to What a Cartoon. So from February 20th, 1995 to November 28th, 1997, 48 original cartoons would premiere via World Premiere Toons, later What a Cartoon. And the very first one would be the Powerpuff Girls, and the second one is Dexter's Lab. So right off the bat, they're like, these are the two series we'll eventually make. They don't know that yet, but from the beginning you could tell, like, you know why they launched with those two first. Like, these are the strongest shorts we have, let's launch with these first.
Yeah, if you're seeing what's being made in the pipeline, I think you can tell they're the strongest. And there was a presentation of, oh, we'll react to the ratings, let's see what people think of it. But you, it definitely, like you said, by choosing which goes first, they knew which ones they wanted to make, regardless of what the reaction would be. And I mean, I definitely think those are the best of the first 2 years, like, by far. Like, I think, like, Mina and the Count, I remember liking all right, but there's others that are like Yucky Duck, I just couldn't get that into.
Yeah, I was looking at a list of these, and I was like, I don't remember any of them outside the ones that became cartoons. One I found later in life was the one called Buy One, Get One Free, which is just, like, them making a new Ren and Stimpy, but it's actually very good. I don't think it could have went anywhere, but it's a very quality short. That's like the one I would look up out of the list of 48 outside of the ones that became cartoons.
Oh, and I remember my Flintstones research. I did see that, like, Hanna-Barbera did direct, like, one or two of them. Like, there's a new Dino one that's, like, okay.
They threw some of these old timers a bone, like Tex Avery had a cartoon contributed to a cartoon. So yeah, there's, like, new creators, but also, like, old timers basically making their last cartoons in this program. And these cartoons received a ton of promotion within and outside the network. Like, they wanted people to know this is a big deal. They would send out, like, posters to places, and later in the run of What a Cartoon, they were having, like, screenings, like, going across the country having screenings of new cartoons. So,
man, I didn't know they definitely made each premiere a big deal. And also they got the tie into Space Ghost that they would do also pulled me into the whole presentation of it. Like, they brought so much prestige to it, which they really needed to, because the like Cartoon Network was the home of a library that Turner bought. He's like, I bought a Hanna-Barbera and MGM library of cartoons, let's dump them on here. And then to finally be done with reruns, like, once you've seen one episode of most shows, like the Hair Bear Bunch, you don't need to watch more.
The Gary Coleman Show.
Yes, yeah, all that junk.
One thing I want to point out, some important context that we talked about earlier in this program, is that this could only happen in the relatively early days of cable. Like, 5 years later, they couldn't have done this, because it was at a point where there were a lot of channels. Most channels were just rerun warehouses, like you said, Henry. So the idea was, put the weirdest thing you can on TV, as much of that as possible, to get people to stop changing channels, because there are so many channels. You want someone to just freeze on yours and remember, this is the channel where the cool, weird stuff is. So that's how we get things like Mystery Science Theater and Space Ghost and Syphil and Ollie and Beavis and Butthead and Nicktoons. It's where all this stuff comes from. This desire to get people to stop changing the channel, because cable was just a wasteland of reruns and, like, old movies. Like, look at the Simpsons episode where they steal cable. It's a description of cable at that point in history, just like nothing, just a wasteland of reruns.
One, and that thought of, like, 500 channels and nothing on, and you have to, it is the medium existing in the way it does. It's something to remember. Like, it is to fight channel flippers. And that's, you know, it's like, why are things made now the way they are? Well, in say in the case of like Netflix and other streaming things, they want to make it in a way that you binge it right now, because that's how you consume things right now. Things in the 90s weren't made in a binge-worthy style. They were made to be like, well, a shotgun of content to just be like, will you watch this weird thing right now?
You're right. The cable networks were not known for original programming, and when it was, it'd be like Silk Stockings or something like that. It wasn't good stuff. But yeah, this was all changing, and by the end of the 90s, people would be like, yeah, I go to cable to watch original shows, especially like premium cable like HBO.
Yeah, yeah. It would be by 2000, 2001... That's when the Emmys were really taken over by cable. I remember hearing, like, that's why they got rid of the Cable Ace Awards, because they didn't need to honor themselves anymore. They were taking over the Emmys with their better stuff than what network wanted to make. Like, and that goes for cartoons too. Like, the animation that was on TV, there's this sad timeline that lines up here where you see, as Cartoon Network in 95, 96, they jump into original programming. That's right around when the networks are getting farther away from paying for it, especially once Pokemon and other anime enters the fray.
And I think this bubble could burst soon, but I think we're seeing something similar with the streaming world. It kind of resembles, in my opinion, the early cable days, where they're making a ton of new programming, a lot of weird stuff, hopefully that you'll stay on that streaming network and not unsubscribe. I think we're seeing a similar situation here, although that bubble could pop at any moment, it feels like. They're investing maybe a little too much.
Yeah, I mean, hey, I'm glad for all our animator friends getting lots of animator jobs on this stuff, as long as they're good jobs, I hope. But yeah, I think especially with Cartoon Network, you know, you're seeing how HBO Max, like, okay, what does AT&T want Cartoon Network programming to be? Do they make stuff that'll be on an app and a TV channel that kids will watch? Or ultimately, do they make things that they want people to sign up for HBO Max for? Like, I do wonder, you've already seen it with Adventure Time. They're like, oh, we canceled Adventure Time too early, but when we make more Adventure Time, we're not putting it on Cartoon Network, we're putting it on HBO Max. Like,
Where can I find new Murphy Brown? I totally forget.
Boy, I bet that's CBS All Access.
You're probably right about that.
Yeah.
So, Seibert wanted to transform Hanna-Barbera, give it a better reputation, and he had a good point. Like, so Seibert has documented all of this on his own blog, so this is my primary source for this, and he has a really good point in that when Hanna-Barbera set up their studio in the early days, it was the factory system, and that system worked because the people working there were people that worked on like Disney stuff and Warner Brothers stuff and UPA stuff, just like the most talented people ever. But over time, that system broke down because they were just hiring anybody. Mm-hmm. Like, the system was hiring anybody. A lot of hacks were getting in. All the old timers were retiring, so they couldn't keep up that level of consistency because it was only built for those mega talented people to be in those spots in the factory.
Yeah. When we talked about the Flintstones and Scooby-Doo, you could see like, oh, there were these masters who could pump out the footage, but eventually they get old, and also a lot of them had, you know, lifestyle issues.
Yes.
And they can't make it into the 70s, and then at a certain point it's like, well, you have Iwo Takamoto and a few others who can maintain some level of quality there, but otherwise it's just like, pump this shit out. We ABC ordered 5 Scooby-Doo shows. We gotta make them all.
And I was surprised that this What a Cartoon thing didn't happen earlier, because as I said, by 95 we have a ton of Nicktoons already, as this is like unrolling on Cartoon Network, so like Nicktoons is well established. But the reason it took so long is that Seibert wanted to do this in the early 90s, but it took him 2 years to wear down Turner executives, because they were like, we are a cable station, we don't make new programming, why would you want to spend all of this money on new programming? We have every Scooby-Doo, we have every Flintstones, like, you're crazy for wanting to spend this money.
Well, and I could also see, you know, Ted Turner himself, he's investing all of his, like, they were making an original programming, they were making Captain Planet, his environmentalist propaganda, so there's only so much budget and energy on that side, and if you're putting so much of it into Captain Planet, I can also see how it's hard to leech off stuff from that.
And
too,
for whatever reason, the new cartoons were airing on TBS, not Cartoon Network, so like Two Stupid Dogs and SWAT Cats, those are TBS shows, they're not Cartoon Network shows, and I didn't realize that until doing this research.
Yeah, I remembered watching it on TBS in both those cases. I think it was to a degree that like there was a time where I didn't have Cartoon Network on my cable.
Me too, yeah.
Like it was, I think it was like mid 94 that it was the event of like, we're getting Cartoon Network. And you better believe like that was all, that was the only channel I had on for like 3 days straight after that. Cause I, you know, not that I didn't love Nickelodeon and MTV, but I was like, I have to see everything I've missed on Cartoon Network.
Did your marathon end when the Hair Bear Bunch came on and you were like, oh, this is what this is now?
You know, I believe it was a marathon of like, it's the first episodes of all these shows. And I remember watching the first episode of the Penelope Pit Stop show. I was like, I think I've had enough. It's 1 a.m. Time to go to bed.
And in his biography of all of this stuff, Seibert gives a lot of credit to our old buddy Mike Lazo, mm-hmm. who would eventually be the guy who spearheaded Adult Swim. So arguably just as important, if not more important, than the What a Cartoon program is Adult Swim.
Yes.
A very similar idea of like weird shotgun approach, just blasting your eyes with all of these weird new shows at once.
Yeah, from that came up in my Ed and Eddie research too, that it was like, well, and this was in a post Seibert era, but it in that case, too, it was like Lazo was one of those approvers too, to could give the budget to things, but he'd also when Adult Swim happened, it was like, okay, you know what, you did all the Space Ghost stuff, make some more Space Ghost over here and we'll work on the kids cartoons.
And they probably thought he was crazy about Adult Swim too, just like, that's insane, this is a kids network, what are you doing, we don't run adult programming.
Yeah.
Like Space Ghost Coast to Coast is as adult as we get.
And that's how they got away with it, because they had like a bunch of stoned interns doing it for no money.
So like, oh, this is free, basically free programming, we'll take it. So I mean, the problem was that they spent a lot of money on Two Stupid Dogs and SWAT Cats for TBS, and they were kind of failures for them. They didn't make enough money. So Seibert's pitch was, instead of spending over $10 million on two public promises like Two Stupid Dogs and SWAT Cats, the promise to the viewer, like, we'll make more of these if you why not spend the same amount on 48 public promises? And that way you add content to the Turner library. And also these shorts could potentially be spun off into individual series. So that was his pitch and they accepted it. They're like, that's a good idea.
Yeah, now I see it as a programming type pitch too, where they're like, well, their blocks, hours and hours of blocks on Cartoon Network were just like, here's a bunch of Tex Avery shorts together. Here's just a bunch of MGM shorts, or here's, I think it was later they got Looney Tunes, but they had packages of shorts. So if they just made a bunch of new 7-minute shorts, those could be, if it flopped in general, they could still be all lumped together as their own programming block ultimately.
And eventually What a Cartoon was just like, well, here's three shorts that never made it in one episode.
Yeah,
so yeah,
I remember that.
And at the end of the day, they received over 5,000 submissions. They had to whittle down to a mere 48. And ultimately Seibert loves cartoons, and he says, we just want funny cartoons. I don't care about the idea for a series. I don't need a series bible. Make a funny cartoon. Pitch me a funny cartoon, and if kids like it, we'll see where we can go from there.
That sounds so different from what I've heard about
pitches
in other things. Like, you have to have a series bible. You have to have, like, a giant plan for, like, well, in season 3, we could see this happening there. Like, all this stuff. And then it sounds like in those early days, he's just like, I need a funny concept. Give me just a funny, make me laugh.
And the big interesting thing about this was that kids could vote on what cartoon would become a series. Now, I don't know. Behind the scenes, I don't know if they've already decided this. I don't know if the kids are just providing a bit of input and they're like, ultimately, we have the decision. But ultimately, Dexter won out of the first 16 What a Cartoon shorts. Dexter won the poll, and that's why it's a series. I couldn't see the timeline quite clearly because there was a second Dexter short made for What a Cartoon. So Powerpuff Girls and Dexter each got two shorts in What a Cartoon.
That. Yeah, I couldn't believe that Dexter did. I was sure it was going to be Powerpuff Girls because Powerpuff Girls was the first short. It was the first one. It was the one I thought of like, this is a world premiere tune. And I think I did like it more just because I do like superhero action stuff quite a lot, even though the combo of nerd plus annoying idiot is always funny to me, for sure.
I wasn't quite sure if the poll basically had them make another pilot and then like, okay, are you guys, do you seriously want this now?
Yeah.
I think maybe that's how it went. I couldn't figure out the timeline, but because of the input from viewers, This was the first Cartoon Network cartoon of this program to become a series. And there are lots of commercials on YouTube where it's like, hey, kids, write in and let us know what's your favorite. Here's our AOL email address. Let us know which one you want to see as a series. So that is really, really cool. And yeah, you're right, Henry. Like, so Powerpuff Girls, it premiered in 95, like February of 95. It would not become a series until over 3 years later.
Yeah.
And the same thing with Courage the Cowardly Dog. It was like a 96 short on the program. 99 to be a cartoon. So like when Powerpuff Girls became a series, I was like, what, really? Now? Okay.
That old show.
Yeah.
That came out. Yeah. Well, I guess.
Three years felt a lot longer too.
Yes. Yeah. To us, 3 years felt like a long time, but maybe to those executives, they're just taking the long view. I mean, I could see that they just didn't have the like staff and ability budget wise to be like, they couldn't concurrently make Dexter and Powerpuff. So it's like once Dexter's over, that's when they could finally do Powerpuff Girls.
And my theory for Ego Trip, the movie, we'll talk about that much later in this podcast, is if they had their choice, they probably would have made the Powerpuff Girls movie, but Powerpuff Girls was an ongoing series.
Yes.
They couldn't stop production on it. I think from the very beginning, it was a major hit and they could have made a movie on VHS way earlier than they eventually did.
Though then their mistake, well not mistake, but then they actually were like, no, bigger than that. This is a theatrical film is what they were doing. But yeah.
So basically the story with Cybert goes that What a Cartoon ends in 97. I believe that's when Hanna-Barbera is dissolved into Time Warner. It no longer exists.
Yes.
As Gendy would say with his accents. he went off to form Frederator Studios. That still exists today. What a Cartoon would have a spiritual successor in the Cartoon Show.
Yeah.
And that would spawn two series itself. It would spawn Codename Kids Next Door and The Grim Adventures of Billy and Mandy with a similar voting process, I believe, called The Big Pick.
Right.
It was a nose-picking analogy.
I remember I was watching Cartoon Network less then, but I do remember that. Yeah, I think Cybert went through kind of a thing recently. He just resigned from Frederator Studios.
He's also like in his 60s too.
Yes, yeah. He did resign. I think he accidentally himself published to Vimeo publicly the third season of, or a whole batch of episodes of Bee and Puppy Cat.
Oh,
that
whoops.
Before they could be released. I think he was able to watch them on Vimeo himself. I know that I've stayed away because I want to support it officially, and I would suggest other people do that because I love Bee and Puppy Cat, but I do believe he accidentally posted like more than five episodes on Vimeo.
Interesting.
Yes. So it's just out there, and I believe his resignation was partially related
to
that.
Wow.
Yeah.
A giant has fallen. But so basically after this, Cartoon Network does their next What a Cartoon with Cartoon, and then essentially, a year after Frederator starts, he goes to Nickelodeon, does a very similar program with like an even bigger scope called Oh Yeah Cartoons.
Right,
so,
right.
What a Cartoon, 48 shorts. Oh Yeah Cartoons, 96 shorts.
Wow, I didn't know it was that many more than What a Cartoon. Man, I thought Oh Yeah was, I guess because I watched fewer Oh Yeah.
I thought it was smaller too, but yeah, that spawned The Fairly Odd Parents, which was like the next hit after SpongeBob for Nickelodeon.
What a huge, I have to say it's probably the second biggest hit after right behind SpongeBob of Nickelodeon.
You got to see that live action movie with Jason Alexander. I think there's more than one.
There's 8 million episodes of that show. And also My Life as a Teenage Robot was another one. We covered that one in a previous podcast
with a Dexter's guy. We'll talk about him, Rob Renzetti. But yeah, so the total amount of series that came out of What a Cartoon are of course Dexter's Lab, Cow and Chicken, Johnny Bravo, The Powerpuff Girls, and Courage the Cowardly Dog was the final one. So those five cartoons, I guess you can count I Am Weasel. That's a spinoff of Cow and Chicken.
Yeah, but that's like also saying like it started Monkey, which is like the Monkey shorts that started with Two Stupid Dogs. Of like Two Stupid Dogs is also the Secret Squirrel Show, but they always have like a set. They had a secondary thing. I didn't like those as much as a kid. I liked it more of like I watched the Dexter Show for pure Dexter.
Yes, and you can see they eventually phased out those extra characters that we'll talk about, but yeah, the, the reboot is just Dexter. It's like we got rid of everybody else. So let's talk about the series Dexter's Lab. We talked about where it came from, the What a Cartoon program. But yeah, Dexter's Lab. I talked about my flawed, you know, analogy where Dexter's Lab is Ren and Stimpy and Powerpuff Girls is SpongeBob. But I honestly think Gendy had to be subconsciously influenced by Ren and Stimpy because he was making the original short at CalArts as Ren and Stimpy was huge. And it is a small, foreign, angry character yelling at a big, stupid character.
Yeah.
More feminine character.
Yeah, the difference between Stimpy and Dee Dee is that Dee Dee is like this, you know, she is thin instead of a potato that Stimpy is. And on top of that, she is like poise and grace. That's her, except she's stupid too. Or I think they increased her brain size as the series goes on. But I think too I think part of it is like it's more naivete on her part, not that she's an idiot.
It's pure ignorance on her part.
Yeah, but as said through her iconic line, "Ooh, what does this button?"
That's
do?
True. That's on all the T-shirts, all the Dee Dee T-shirts. But yeah, even if he wasn't directly influenced by Ren and Stimpy, and that's impossible given when he made this short and how big Ren and Stimpy was in the animation community and in like just in terms of the world.
Yeah,
I think the reason people reacted so strongly to Dexter was because of their pre-baked in love for Ren and Stimpy, where it's like I like this dynamic of the small angry foreign thing yelling at the big dumb thing. It's great.
Yeah, I mean, for him and all of his buddies who would go on to make the show, I can't see how Gendy, if he's, you know, in college and studying animation in 1991 or 92, how could you not be a Spumco super fan? Like, in right then, how could you not be? Every kid was. And if you're a creator who's like, was so worried, we talked a little about this with Bill Kopp. If you're one of these creators who are so worried, I'm going to have to work on some fucking He-Man cartoon, and then you see Ren and Stimpy, like, that is just this spark, and to a lesser extent Rugrats and Doug, but really Ren and Stimpy, it's this giant spark of like, holy shit, I could do this.
Yeah, they're letting this on TV and I could be part of it. So yeah, I honestly think that was a huge influence, and I could not find any like comment on the record, of course not, but I don't think this could exist without Ren and Stimpy.
No way.
Let's talk about Gendy Tartakovsky. So that's how you say his name. I looked it up in an official video. Actually, there's a very good video online that is the an extra on the Samurai Jack DVD. Basically every DVD extra is just online now. Mm-hmm. So have fun, but it's a very good biography of Gendy with him speaking on the record about his life.
Yeah, I just watched it this morning too, and you get to hear the late Mako.
Yes, although I was listening, and that could be his white impersonator they eventually used when Avatar ended. I didn't look at the credits of the speakers, but he might have been game for it. Who knows?
Could be. Yeah, it was really informative about his life, and like you get to know the guy pretty well, and he's an interesting guy. That especially, well, I mean, to know his feelings as an immigrant to America, it makes me reflect more on Dexter's accent, yes, for example.
Although that idea came from a different place, and we'll talk about it, but I have to assume it's because of him, and in part. So Gendy, born in Moscow to a dentist and an assistant principal, his family eventually immigrated to America after growing anti-Semitic sentiments in their community. So they were afraid of dying, I guess. And they're like, America might like Jews more. So they went to America, briefly stopped over in Italy, settled in Ohio, but then they're like, oh, Ohio sucks. And I agree. Went to Chicago. So he's in Chicago growing up.
The big second city.
The land of big shoulders, or whatever they call it.
In that doc, when he talks about like his just growing love of American culture, well, I mean, definitely, when I see his you know, kid art, I know the exact comic books he's reading in the late 70s, early 80s, and that he's emulating. Like, he is a Marvel boy for sure.
Actually, so when he went to America, one of the first things he did was go to a 7-Eleven with his family, and he bought a Super Friends comic book.
Wow.
And that was the first comic book he'd ever seen, and that is what he cites as changing his life, which explains why the Justice Friends are in Dexter completely.
For sure. Wow. Yeah. I love the Justice Friends. They're so great. I see so much like of even more so in Samurai Jack and his action stuff, but like you can tell, huge fan of Jack Kirby. Mm-hmm. He loves just like Jack Kirby, like figures. He's so into that. And in addition, like, I see so much Frank Miller, 80s Frank Miller in his style, John Byrne a bit too. Like, there's so much of that in there. And like that, I think that is a thing that drew me to it, because those were, in 92 is when I super got into, you know, Marvel and to a lesser extent DC Comics, and I could just see that in his work, like especially when he draws Krunk.
Yeah,
like it's the best. It is a perfect Hulk. I love that Hulk.
So jumping ahead to his adult life, he briefly studied film at the Columbia College of Chicago, and then he moved to LA with his friend Rob Renzetti, we'll talk about him soon, and attended, you guessed it, CalArts. Mm-hmm. And there he would also meet a longtime collaborator, Craig McCracken, which sounds like a cartoon name.
He's
destined to make cartoons.
We got to cover more McCracken in the year to come.
He has a new show on Netflix in February.
Really?
Yes.
Oh boy.
So look forward to that.
Yeah, and Renzetti we talked a lot about in the only show he created, My Life as a Teenage Robot. Yeah.
So after 2 years of CalArts, I don't know if he graduated from CalArts actually, but after 2 years of CalArts, he would go to Spain with Rob Renzetti to briefly work on Batman the Animated Series. The episodes produced by this animation studio in Spain.
Wow.
that actually folded during the production of an episode, so the episode had to be finished by another studio.
That's wild that he had to go to Spain to work on this. Like, when he's studying in CalArts, he's probably like within 20 miles of where Warner Animation is working on the show. But for him to work on it, he has to go to Spain to work at a satellite studio.
That is crazy. And yeah, he basically left CalArts. He didn't finish his senior thesis, which was a short similar to Dexter. It was just basically a 2.5 minute pencil test, but he never finished it because there was a job waiting for him. And when he went to Spain, that is where he learned the ropes of, you know, animation production, what it's like to be a grunt in that world.
Yeah, and hey, the Batman action is like perfect for what there's so much, like the Batman school of character design for action, these like, you know, giant bodies and these perfect body types, and the extreme Kirby aesthetic to it really fits for what Gendy is good at drawing.
So the studio he worked at was called Lapis Azul, and apparently they went bankrupt during the production of the episode Day of the Samurai.
Oh, wow.
So,
that is one of the best. That's extra funny that the Samurai Jack guy was working on Day of the Samurai.
I wasn't even thinking of that. So yeah, I don't think he was in Spain very long, but what happened next is, so Craig McCracken, future Powerpuff Girls creator, he got hired at Hanna-Barbera as the art director on Two Stupid Dogs, and then he got his old buddies Rob Renzetti and Gendy hired on the show as well. And together, this group of rowdy Gen Xers worked in a trailer within the Hanna-Barbera lot, and Paul Rudish was there as well. So Paul Rudish is the guy,
Mr. Mickey Mouse.
Exactly.
Yeah.
He made all the crazy, he led all the crazy Mickey Mouse shorts in the 2010s, and I believe he's part of the new series they inexplicably renamed for the 2020s.
Yeah, I don't, I feel like that's just to have a different series page on Disney Plus something.
I have to say, the Wonderful World of Mickey Mouse is better than just Mickey Mouse.
Yeah, maybe
it's hard to find like Mickey Mouse, like when I'm looking for those shorts.
I guess that's also, that shows you the changing business practices of Disney in 2013 was like, we need kids to watch this on like their phone or some shit, so just call it Mickey Mouse. But now they're like, no, the World of Mickey Mouse, which is a page within the original section of the Disney Plus app.
It's a wonderful world. So now we can talk about Dexter's Lab and the history of that show. So we're finally here. I don't know, what are we at on the time?
49 minutes.
Wow, this is gonna be a long history. So the What a Cartoon pilot program has started, and Tartakovsky had one submission to enter, and that was his pitch based on an unfinished CalArts senior thesis project. So at the time, he was working at The Critic. So he went from Two Stupid Dogs to The Critic.
Wow.
And he was an animation timer on The Critic, not very happy working on that show.
Oh.
And he got a call from someone at Cartoon Network that was like, hey, you know that pencil test that you got? Make that into a pitch. We need pitches, so you should pitch this to us. And that pencil test, he'd been showing it around. It got him hired on Batman.
Mm,
and you can see little tiny chunklets of it in that YouTube DVD special features thing.
I saw a little of that. Yeah. There's some, you can definitely see the roots of Dexter in there, though the characters don't, you know, look exactly the same or anything. He matured a lot character design wise, I think, from student to by the time he pitched it.
Dee Dee is kind of the same, but Dexter is like a little more three dimensional in terms of how he's drawn. He's not like the flat, like perfect icon you can see on your television screen.
I love the flat cubeness of Dexter so much. As time goes on, I love it more and more.
So yeah, he developed this short into a pitch, and Seibert wasn't very hot on the idea. He went ahead with the pilot because The Room seemed to like it, so they were like, this could be one of the shorts. Like, the thing that Seibert thought was a sure thing was Cow and Chicken. They're like, Cow and Chicken forever. Cow and Chicken rules. This is going to be the future of our network, Cow and Chicken. I don't like Cow and Chicken.
Cow and Chicken is the Ren and Stimpiest of them, for sure.
Yeah, I mean, this is slightly Ren and Stimpy. Cow and Chicken, just like, what if Ren and Stimpy were on in a barnyard or something?
Yeah,
I don't know.
I like Cow and Chicken okay, but they're, well, we've talked before, like, sometimes scatological stuff is too much for me, and I think there's, not to say that Dexter never got scatological or had, like, a booger joke or a fart or whatever, but there's something about the internal cuteness of Dexter made it easier for me, but Cow and Chicken wants to be gross.
Yeah, like, I know our buddy Thad Komorowski likes it. I just, maybe he needs to show me better shorts, but I remember watching it a bit as a kid. I like some of the race year shorts where Chicken was like, he had to stop smoking.
Sure.
And I was like, wow, a smoking cartoon character. This is cool.
And I mean, hey, I love the voice of Charlie Adler, and I want to hear it like screamed at me, and that's the only voice I hear.
What
like,
if he was four characters?
and that also makes Michael Dorn's voice as Weasel like this wonderful like oasis away from the Charlie Adler voice. The Weasel shorts, I actually hate it even more because the character of Baboon is just so gross looking to me with his like
red butts,
his red ass right in your face for some reason.
Smelling his finger all the time.
I know what you're doing with that stuff.
We can cover it at some point. Yeah. But they go off to make this short. Remember, Gendy is a super young guy. He's never finished a short.
Oh my god.
Most of the time, if you're, you know, a first time creator of a program like Dexter's, you made a short in college. You made several shorts, like Joe Murray did. John Kay had worked on the Jetsons and stuff. Klasky Csupo made like commercials and whatnot. Like all these people had existing animation history.
Lupo before he did the Brothers Grunt. You usually have a completed short that you can watch in full. Like the Courage the Cowardly Dog guy, he made a more than one like Oscar, a student Oscar winning short.